Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, you're joining us as we unpack a really insightful legal battle, Linder v. Meadow Gold Dairies, Inc.
That's right.
Now, on the surface, this might seem like just a disagreement over a farm lease, you know, in Hawaii.
Mm.
But stick with us,
yeah,
because this case is actually loaded with fundamental lessons.
Absolutely. Things like contract law, the crucial role of the statute of limitations.
Right. And those often overlooked complexities of third-party litigation. We've sifted through the court documents, the briefs, really trying to bring you the key legal principles and, well, the practical takeaways that are super relevant for you as law students.
Exactly. What's fascinating about Linder v. Meadow Gold is how, you know, a seemingly straightforward business agreement, just a lease for a dairy farm, can become this tangled web of legal issues.
Yeah.
The story really kicks off back in 1988. Jeffrey Linder leases his property in Hawaii to Meadow Gold Dairies. It was initially a 10-year term, but with options to renew all the way out to 2013.
Okay, so a pretty long-term commitment right from the get-go. And the money side involved both a minimum rent and then a percentage based on the farm's output, right?
That's correct. And importantly, the lease also included these arbitration clauses, specifically to handle disagreements about, say, rent adjustments.
Okay.
Then you fast forward to 97, and Meadow Gold assigns the lease to another company, Southern Foods Group, or SFG.
Right, SFG. But here's a critical point, and you mentioned this, Meadow Gold didn't just, like, wash their hands of it. They stayed liable under the original lease.
Precisely. They were still on the hook. And then, boom, 2000 hits. And that's where the main conflict really sparks. Meadow Gold decides to terminate the lease 13 years early.
13 years, wow.
Yeah, and as you can imagine, that immediately triggers the liquidated damages clause in the contract.
Makes sense.
But the dispute wasn't just about that early termination payment. Linder also brought up some pretty serious environmental concerns, specifically about what got termed a cattle graveyard on the property.
Okay, cattle graveyard, that sounds problematic.
Yeah. It does. So you've got this mix of contract law, environmental allegations, and as we'll get into, some really interesting procedural twists and turns.
So our mission today is basically to dissect these different legal threads, see how they connect, and really understand the bigger legal principles at play.
Exactly. Let's do it.
All right. Let's jump into that first major point then.
Mm-hmm.
The liquidated damages and Meadow Gold's attempt to dodge them by arguing frustration of purpose. Linder sued for these pre-agreed damages because Meadow Gold bailed early.
Yeah.
What was the core of Meadow Gold's argument? Why shouldn't they have to pay?
Well, what's particularly interesting is they leaned heavily on this legal doctrine, frustration of purpose. They basically argued that unforeseen changes in government regulations and also constant complaints from neighbors made it impossible for them to run the dairy profitably.
So the fundamental purpose running a profitable dairy was frustrated, in their view.
That was their argument. But the court ultimately didn't buy it. They granted summary judgment to Linder on this point.
Okay, so why did that frustration of purpose claim fall flat? What's the standard there?
Well, the court applied a really strict interpretation. The legal standard for frustration of purpose requires the event, the thing that supposedly frustrates the purpose, to be genuinely unforeseeable, like completely outside what the parties could have reasonably anticipated.
Okay.
And it has to be so fundamental that it essentially destroys the entire basis of the contract.
Like a meteor hitting the farm, maybe.
Perhaps something that extreme. But here, the court said, look, regulatory changes, neighbor complaints, while maybe annoying or costly, those are actually foreseeable business risks when you're operating a dairy farm. They weren't these totally unexpected cataclysmic events that would just wipe out the whole point of the lease.
Right. That makes sense. It's part of the cost of doing business, potentially.
Exactly. And this really highlights a core principle. Courts are generally hesitant to let parties out of contracts just because things get tough or less profitable than they hoped. You accept certain risks.
And what about the liquidated damages clause itself? The court upheld that too.
Yes, they did. The court saw it as a reasonable pre-estimate of the harm Linder would likely suffer because Meadow Gold left early. The key distinction is that it wasn't seen as penalty, just trying to punish Meadow Gold.
Mm-hmm.
It was viewed as a fair attempt made back when they signed the lease to figure out the likely financial hit if one side broke the deal prematurely.
Okay, so a big takeaway for listeners.
Mm-hmm.
Liquidated damages clauses, generally enforceable if they look like a genuine estimate of potential harm, not just a punishment.
Mm.
And that frustration of purpose defense, it's a really high bar. Normal business difficulties, probably not going to cut it.
You got it. Now, let's pivot to that second big issue. the alleged breach of lease covenants, specifically this rather grim cattle graveyard situation.
Right. Lindner claimed Meadow Gold burying, was it, over 1,200 cattle violated the lease terms.
Yes, and he alleged it polluted a nearby stream. He'd apparently even mentioned it in a letter way back in 1999.
Okay. And on this point, unlike the liquidated damages, the court didn't grant summary judgment. Why the different outcome here?
Well, this really gets into the importance of facts, you know. The court found there were genuine disputes of material fact, things that actually matter to the legal outcome.
Like what specifically?
For instance, did burying the cattle like that actually violate lease terms about good husbandry, basically, farming responsibly, or rules against waste actions that damage the property's value?
Oh, no.
And critically, did it actually harm the land's value, like Lindner claimed? These weren't things the court could just decide based on the legal arguments alone. There were real factual disagreements.
So summary judgment wasn't appropriate because you couldn't just say, based on the undisputed facts, the law says X. The facts themselves were in question.
Precisely. When key facts that could swing the case one way or the other are disputed, summary judgment is off the table. The court essentially said, we need a trial, we need to hear the evidence, figure out what actually happened, then apply the law.
Gotcha. So it really underscores how critical factual evidence is and how disputes over those facts can force a case towards a full trial.
Absolutely.
Okay, makes sense. Now, let's wade into the statute of limitations. It's popped up in a couple different ways, right? First, regarding those alleged lease violations, like the cattle graveyard itself, Lindner sued in 2006. Hawaii's limit is 6 years. How did that timing affect his claims?
Yeah, the timing is crucial. And what's insightful here is how the court distinguished between different kinds of violations. They ruled that claims for breaches of use covenants, things Meadow Gold did or didn't do regarding how they used the property, if those specific acts happened before July 19, 2000, exactly 6 years before Lindner filed suit, then those claims were time barred. Gone. Too late.
Okay, so isolated incidents from before that date were out. But you mentioned an exception for ongoing violations.
Yeah.
How did that work with the cattle graveyard?
Yeah.
Right, the concept of a continuing violation. The court said, okay, maybe the initial burying happened before July 2000, but the cattle were still there, decomposing, potentially causing issues, right up until the lease actually ended in December 2000.
I see.
That ongoing presence, that continued state of affairs within the six-year window, was seen as a continuing breach. So claims related to the impact of the graveyard during that later period, after July 19, 2000, were not time barred.
Interesting. So it's not just about the starting point, but whether the breach or its effects continued into that critical six-year period before filing suit.
Exactly. It shows the statute of limitation of the clock doesn't always start and stop cleanly with the first action. Continuous breaches are treated differently.
Okay. Now, the statute of limitations also came up with the rent payments, but that application seemed a bit different.
It is, yeah. When you're dealing with periodic payments like monthly or quarterly rent, Hawaii law treats each missed payment as its own separate legal claim.
Its own mini lawsuit, almost.
In a way, yes. Each missed payment starts its own six-year statute of limitations clock running from the date that specific payment was due.
Okay.
This prevents someone from waiting, say, 10 years and then suing for a decade's worth of back rent all at once, but it still allows them to chase the more recent unpaid amounts.
So Lindner was going after additional rent, both minimum and percentage, from late 98 through the end of 2000.
Yeah.
How did the six-year rule apply there?
Applying that principle, the court looked at each payment's due date, any rent that was due on or before July 19th, 2000. Again, that six-year cutoff before the 2006 lawsuit was time-barred. Lindner couldn't recover those earlier amounts in this suit.
Okay, so the older rent claims were lost. But what about rent due after July 19th, 2000?
Ah, those were different. Specifically, the minimum rent due October 1st, 2000, and the percentage rent that would have been due around January 30th, 2001, those fell within the six-year window, so they were not time-barred.
But there was another twist with those, right? They didn't just go to trial.
Correct, and this is important. The court ruled that these remaining timely rent disputes were actually subject to the mandatory arbitration clause in the original lease.
Ah, back to the arbitration clause.
Exactly. So those specific rent claims had to be kicked out of court and resolved through arbitration as the parties had originally agreed.
Wow. Okay, that's a really vital distinction for students to grasp. The statute of limitations works one way for ongoing physical breaches, but differently for periodic payments like rent, where each missed payment is its own thing with its own deadline.
Absolutely. And it really hammers home the need to track those due dates carefully and act promptly.
Definitely. Okay, let's shift gears slightly to a more procedural point. Third-party practice. This involves Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 14. Meadow Gold brought SFG, the company they assigned the lease to, into the lawsuit as a third party. And then SFG started raising defenses against Lindner's claims, defenses Meadow Gold hadn't even used. How does that work?
Yeah, this is where Rule 14A2C comes into play. It's a specific part of the federal rules that explicitly allows a third-party defendant, like SFG here, to assert any defenses against the plaintiff, Lindner, that the original defendant, Meadow Gold, could have asserted.
So even if Meadow Gold, for whatever reason, didn't raise a statute of limitations defense, SFG could jump in and say, "Hold on, Lindner, your claim against Meadow Gold for this specific thing is too old."
Exactly that. The reasoning behind this rule is basically fairness and efficiency. SFG got dragged into this lawsuit by Meadow Gold.
Right.
They have a direct financial stake in the outcome, specifically in limiting how much Meadow Gold might be found liable for, because that could potentially flow down to SFG.
Because they took over the lease. Okay.
Right. So allowing SFG to raise defenses that Meadow Gold could have raised protects SFG's own interests. The court essentially said SFG could stand in Meadow Gold's shoes defensively against Lindner.
That's fascinating. It really shows that third-party defendants aren't just sitting on the sidelines. They have active rights to protect themselves, and they aren't necessarily stuck with the original defendant's strategic choices or mistakes.
Absolutely. It highlights that bringing in a third party isn't just adding another name to the case. It adds another strategic player with their own rights and potential defenses. Everyone involved needs to be aware of all possible arguments, especially something like the statute of limitations.
Okay, so as we wrap up this deep dive into Lindner v. Meadow Gold, let's try to crystallize the main takeaways for our listeners, particularly the law students tuning in. What stands out most?
Well, first off, I think it just screams the importance of clear, precise drafting in contracts, especially leases. Things like rent due dates, triggers for arbitration, what's allowed or not allowed on the property. Being explicit upfront can prevent so many headaches and, frankly, expensive lawsuits later.
Couldn't agree more. Ambiguity is like inviting a dispute. What else?
Second, the absolute necessity of filing claims on time. Understanding the statute of limitations isn't just academic, it's practical. And knowing how it applies differently to various breaches, like ongoing physical issues versus periodic payments, is crucial. We saw how Lindner lost out on some rent claims because of timing.
Yeah, that's a hard lesson. Don't sit on your rights.
Definitely not. And third, the strategic side of third-party practice under Rule 14. Realizing that third-party defendants have teeth, they can raise defenses, they can change the dynamic of the litigation, that's a key piece of procedural understanding.
Absolutely. And maybe a fourth point, the court's enforcement of the arbitration clause.
Yes, good point. It shows that when parties agree to arbitrate, courts generally respect that agreement. If the clause is valid, disputes covered by it will likely be sent to arbitration, not fought out in court.
Which often aligns with goals of efficiency and potentially lower costs.
Often, yes.
So when you pull back and look at all these layers, contract interpretation, statutes of limitations, procedural rules like FRCP 14, it really makes you think, how does a seemingly simple dairy farm lease spiral into such a multifaceted legal beast?
It really does.
And it leads to the final thought for our listeners. What proactive steps can you, as future legal professionals, take right from the start, maybe even at the contract drafting stage, to anticipate and maybe head off these kinds of complex challenges for your clients?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Something definitely worth pondering.
Indeed. Well, thanks for joining us for this deep dive. Until our next exploration.